are listening to WQ4D Radio, the Inspiring Friends Network.
The Never Say Impossible Show is on the air. Be heard. Be discovered. Be connected. Build your business. Listen each week to successful people who will inspire you, motivate you, and share with you innovative ways to breathe new life into your business. Never say impossible, because nothing is impossible until you say it is. And now, here's your Never Say Impossible host, Myra Goldick.
Hello again. If this happens to be your first time tuning in to WQ4D Radio and the Never Say Impossible show, our mission is to introduce you to some fantastic people who have achieved great success and have overcome great obstacles in their life. Very often, the path to success is a rough and bumpy road. Our guests will share their personal stories with you and inspire you to never say impossible. So if you're one of those people who can never learn enough, you are in the right place. We will entertain you and keep you up to date with business trends, technology, spirituality, and healthcare. Our guests will open new doors, new networking opportunities, business opportunities, artistic opportunities, and just generally keep you entertained. Our topic today is In a Flash. In a Flash is a powerful story of survival. Today we will hear how one young woman survived a brain aneurysm, lived to tell her story, and is helping others and their families keep their faith when they're faced with life-changing adversity. Kim Justice. A piercing pain suddenly shot through Kim's brain, like a bolt of lightning, snapping and tracing through the sky. An ordinary day was instantly transformed into a fight for survival. Soon, she underwent aggressive brain surgery. Her doctor's initial misdiagnosis led to her speech and comprehension being severely compromised before she lost consciousness. From the depth of a coma, Kim entered a near-death experience, awakening to find her life profoundly changed. Facing mortality, changes in her body, mind, and spirit were thrust upon her without warning. Her courageous fight to overcome unconventional obstacles is intimately shared in this compelling story. In a Flash, Miracles Here and Beyond offers Kim's personal account of her battle to survive a ruptured brain aneurysm, the presentation of a near-death experience, and the miracles that ensued. This book is a powerful, powerful explanation of how she fought for survival, challenges of faith, divine orchestration that came to play. Kim artfully describes a journey where the tenets of science and spirituality collide, resulting in a dynamic union. Have you ever questioned if there's life after death, or if there's really such a thing as divine intervention? In a Flash is a poignant memoir of miracles following Kim Jefferson Justice on her compelling journey through a ruptured brain aneurysm. Kim's book offers encouragement, inspiration, and motivation to individuals and their loved ones. So before I tell you any more, I will tell you that it can't be told any better than through Kim herself, who lived it. Welcome, Kim.
Hello, Myra. Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well,
literally and figuratively.
Yes. And we are so delighted that you are sharing this story with our listeners. I didn't mention in your bio that you are not only a published writer, but you are also a photographer, and you have spent 25 years as a financial consultant.
Yes.
I want to jump right in.
Good.
And get to 1995. When your illness happened. And, you know, what really took place in 1995? And then what prompted you to write this book?
Okay. Well, in 1995, I had been, about 7 to 10 years, let's see, we'll do the math. In 1981, I became a financial consultant. I was working in a family business. My dad did that before me. I worked all on commission, but I did office with my family, and was successful, 35 years old, at the top of my game, I thought, at least physically. You know, physically and mentally, and probably spiritually, although that deepened and was enhanced and expanded. But just a typical day in the life, and it started out that way anyway. And one of the miracles that I talk about in my book, I'll back up for 1 second, is that at the end of 1994, one of the things I did in my job was set up employee benefit packages, and I had the opportunity to quote the largest group that I had ever had the opportunity to do in my career in the fall. And so I had been working feverishly in the last quarter of 1994 trying to land this huge case, and I found out a couple of weeks before Christmas that I landed this case, and in effect, it more than doubled my income beginning January 1st. And so there was obviously a big celebration. I was really happy going into the holidays that year, even happier than usual, and everything was great. And the case was signed, sealed, and delivered for January 1st. On January 9th, like a lot of people, after the holidays, I wasn't quite ready to have my head all the way back in the game, especially since I had just had this big success, and I was planning on sneaking out of the office a little early. And so there was a piece of paperwork that I could have easily mailed to this new client, but I decided that I wanted to drive down there and drop it off, just to get out a little early, and I made the mistake of mentioning that a little too loud to the administrative assistant, and my father overheard me say it. And he put down his pen, and something that just never happened, you think we work in the office same, we work in the same office, but our careers were down different directions, and so we really didn't spend any time together except passing in the halls at the office. But he put down his pen that day and said, "Why don't I drive down there with you, and we'll stop and get a cappuccino afterwards." It's in our downtown Old Market area where there's a lot of shops like that. And I said, "Great." I kind of shot myself in the foot with my sneaking out. But as it turned out, he wound up driving. We went down, dropped off the paperwork to the client. It wound up being significant for another reason, that he happened to be with me out of the blue that day, because he also got to meet the client then. So they had another contact in my office that they had the opportunity to meet. But this is January 9th, a Monday. We drop the paperwork off, we leave, we've driven about a half a block, and suddenly a pain rips through my head. like an axe had just been buried in it. It was the most intense, sharp, excruciating pain just out of the blue. And I yelped and drew in my hands and my legs. And my dad looked at me and said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I need to go to a hospital," which wasn't anything I had ever said before.
And I'm sure you didn't say it that way.
No, I was braced. I was kind of bracing myself against the seat and trying to figure out what in the heck, you know, when you just get struck like that. I was trying to assimilate it, you know, quickly, but I knew that it was bad. I knew whatever it was not a good thing. And I said, "I need to go to a hospital." And he didn't even question me, but another miracle as I see it is that, again, we're on January 9th, he had gotten his first cell phone for Christmas, one of those the size of a shoebox kind of cell phones.
Yeah.
And, remember those?
Yeah.
And interestingly, our longtime family doctor also served on the board of directors of a big insurance company, one of them that we used. And so my dad happened to have his number in that telephone or was used to dialing that number for business reasons more than personal reasons. But he called our doctor and said there was something wrong and had him meet us at the emergency room of the hospital. And upon examination, he said she's having a muscle spasm in her neck and gave my dad pain pills and sent me home. Now,
oh my.
At the time, I didn't think that was the case, but keep in mind that from the time I was struck, the pain never relented. It was still going at the same throttle. It hadn't eased up. It started with just rip, this intense pain, and it was still going on. So every minute that was passing, every hour that was passing, you know, was cumulative time of being in this. My brains were scrambled. I couldn't quite think, but at least my reaction at that time was that it was so painful. I didn't think that was the case, but I wasn't really in a position to argue, and I guess my hope was that if I took the pain pills, maybe it would make whatever this was go away so I could think clearly, you know, and then reapproach it. But, you know, again, had I been driving that day at the point that it happened, my hands...
You may not be here.
Right. My hands would have come off the wheel, my feet would have come off the pedals, and who knows what would have happened. And then the second thing then, bringing us back to the emergency room, is that at the time, I had recently bought my first house, and I lived by myself. I was single, and had I gone to the hospital, you know, made it to the hospital, or a friend would have dropped me at the hospital and then dropped me home, I would have gone home to my house and died over the next 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there's a lot of miracles, as I see it, through the process of my dad happening to be there that day, because his response was, you know, why don't you come over to our house, my parents' house, until the pain pills kick in, and then we'll take you home. Just want to make sure that you're okay, because, you know, I had not been a doctor goer, you know, or a hospital person, so he knew it had to be extremely serious for me to be reacting the way that I was. And so I did go to my parents' house, and I had been there a few hours, and I started getting violently ill. I was dizzy and throwing up, and this pain still hadn't relented, and it was just a terrible...
You must have felt as though you were dying.
Yes, I did.
You were, probably.
And I was, because... In fact, what had happened, and I wouldn't know it until much later, is that my aneurysm had ruptured at the point that pain ensued. And now what was going on is that blood was seeping into my brain as all this is happening, this misdiagnosis over 24 hours. And so as I'm getting violently ill, they call this doctor and talk to him, and he says, well, the pain medication is too strong. You need to cut it in half. You know, try a lower dose of it. And so through that night, that wasn't, in fact, you know, what it was. And so I continued to get sick. And now I'm getting very weak between getting sick and the relentless pain
for hours. Dehydration.
Yes. Right, mm-hmm. Right, all of that. I'm just so sick. And yes, it was, you know, at that point in the night, I didn't think that I would make it until morning. I couldn't communicate. It's very hard to explain, you know, to people when an episode like that is going on in your head, you're just not able to think like you do on a regular day or communicate. You know, I think you're really just trying to hang on to life and trying to figure out yourself what the heck is going on. But by morning, my speech was starting to be affected. I would get to maybe, in the beginning, maybe about every 12th word like that, and I wouldn't be able to get it out. I would see the word in my head, know what I was meaning to say, but I just wouldn't be able to get the word out. And my mom was studying my face, looking at me, and she would finish the sentence for me. So we communicated that way for a little while, and I still understood her, but I was having trouble talking. And by that time, you know, if my parents didn't have a clue before, they were, now it was really coming home that there was something really, really wrong. And in a very short time, you know, within about a half an hour, those dozen words I was able to say were now down to no words, and I could no longer understand her. I was looking at her face trying to talk to me, and I had no idea what she was saying. And I was very agitated because now, you know, everything was bad enough, but now I couldn't talk, I couldn't understand, and I was really in an isolated place in my head. I could no longer communicate what was going on with my head. I couldn't communicate anything, and I couldn't understand anything. And so my parents promptly put me in the car at that point and were taking me back to the hospital no matter what. And at this point, I don't have a memory of the next 11 days, but apparently I did walk in on my own weekly, practically crawling in, but I guess I did get there, you know, walk in on my own. But within probably an hour, I went into a coma for the next 11 days. But as soon as I got there, they were asking me questions, trying to admit me, like, did I know what year it was, what day it was, things like that. And I was clueless. I had no idea what they were talking about. I remember trying to get out answers. I remember thinking that I should know these things. Somewhere reverberating through the pain, I remember having the conscious awareness I should know the answer to these questions and try to answer them, you know, kind of like when you're in school as a kid. But I just couldn't answer. And they, at that point, like I say, I don't have memory, but they immediately did a CAT scan and an MRI, and it showed right there that I had a ruptured brain aneurysm that had been seeping blood into my brain. And at that point, they found a neurosurgeon. And again, I see a blessing in that, because the technology, micro-neurosurgical techniques, were relatively new at the time. Before that, you pretty much died, or they took their chances just doing open brain surgery, you know, trying to work in a tiny place with great big equipment. and the outcome for quality of life wasn't very good. And in fact, when I had my aneurysm, about 3% made it at all back in 1995. But as fate would have it, there was a visiting surgeon who studied with another surgeon from Europe who was termed the father of micro neurosurgical techniques, and he happened to be in Omaha, where I live, at a teaching hospital. He had been there for 2 years. He wound up leaving about a year after I had my procedure, and so he was right where I needed him to be when I needed him, and I was a case right up his alley, and so he took the case. Again, this happened on Monday. On Tuesday, we're finding out what it is. The surgeon has come in, and he's told my parents that there's a choice to be made. I'm going to have this open brain surgery, absolutely, but timing was an issue. They could do it right then, but my brain was extremely swollen, and that didn't leave very much room to work. And so the quality of life was going to be, if I made it at all, it was pretty rough trying to work under those circumstances, and my quality of life could be severely compromised. The other alternative would be to feed medicine into my veins that would hopefully bring the swelling down and give them a little more room to work and enhance the chances for my quality of life. But the risk in waiting is that what had already built up enough pressure to rupture and start seeping blood through my brain could burst and I would die instantly. So I'm an only child. I think for any child, for any parent, that would have been a horrible place and decision, you know, to have to make. But they did know me well enough to know that I would want to opt for the better chances for quality of life, and so that's what we did, is waited. And by that time, I was on life support. When I went into a coma on that Tuesday, I was in critical condition and put on life support. And so that's where I remained until Friday, which happened to be Friday the 13th that year. And that was when I had my brain surgery. And the surgery was a success from the standpoint that he was able to clip off the aneurysm, clean out, vacuum out the blood that had seeped into various cavities of my brain, put me back together, and I lived through surgery. And that was the victory that day. As for how I was going to turn out when I came to, that was up for grabs. They really have no idea how that's going to work, and it took another 3 days for me to wake up. So,
Kim, this, you know, I need to interject something here. If anyone listening doubts the presence of divine intervention,
right,
I think that this would remove all doubts, because you definitely were not meant to die, and you were given gifts from a higher power at that point that made this whole survival possible for you. And your strength and what you're doing, and which we're going to get into, what you're doing, it made it possible because your mission was very important to other people. Now, I want you to pick up where you left off and when you came to.
I will back up one moment. Somewhere in the depths of that coma, one of the other gifts I was given, and why I wrote the book, one of the many reasons I wrote the book, is that from the depths of a coma at some point, and there's no sense of time there, but I had been, pardon me, blank, you know, no conscious thought while I was in a coma. But suddenly, it was as if you were laying down on the sofa and somebody put a piece of green cloth over your eyes so that that was the only thing in your field of vision when you opened your eyes. Suddenly, I became aware of the color green. And I remember looking at it. That was all I could see. But what was interesting is that the color was so sharp and heightened and intense and brilliant that it was like no color I had ever seen before. And so that color, from the moment I saw it, it starts panning back, panning back, panning back slowly. And while this is happening, I'm not afraid. I'm curious. I have the curiosity of a child, and I'm just looking at this color, and it backs up to the extent that I see it is a sprig of a pine-type tree. And I can see the needles, and I can see those little knobby brown things that are on the branch, and it's almost like I'm part of the tree. It's all magnified, and I'm just looking in wonder at this branch. And the scene continues to pan back until now I'm standing next to that tree, looking out onto an expanse of green grass and blue sky and a few white pillowy clouds floating overhead, and I'm again looking at all of these things just in wonder, because now there's more colors and they're all almost alive. I know that probably doesn't make sense, but they were just so sharpened and intense. And I see a group of people out in the distance, and they're all in period clothing, some in clothing that I recognize from now, our current time, and others from different periods. And it was almost like a Sunday social kind of thing. They were out in the distance laughing, going about their business. And at that time, I saw a little girl entered my frame of vision, and I'd say she was, you know, maybe between 5 and 7 years old, had really long blonde hair that was secured back with long flowing ribbons, and she was in like a pioneer type dress, little house on the prairie type dress, and she ran through my field of vision, and she was playing a game. It was the one where it looks like a hula hoop, but they're rolling it upright, guiding it with a stick. And the little girl was laughing, and as she ran through from right to left and then was out of my field of vision, but that had drawn my attention away from the group because she was closer running through. And I remember feeling the sensation of smiling and joy at observing her joy and happiness. And then, after she ran out of view, my eyes locked on a pair of shoes, the back of a man who had his back to me. My eyes were on this pair of shoes, and my eyes started trailing up the man's body, and as my vision is moving up, he's proceeding to turn around toward me, so that at the point my eyes made it to his face, to his eyes, and our eyes locked, I immediately recognized him as my grandpa. My eyes locked, I knew it was my grandfather. I wanted to advance to go to him, and he communicated to me that it wasn't my time. It was as if I hit a piece of plexiglass, boom. I couldn't advance, and it was over. I was back into my body.
I have goosebumps. We are going to break. I'm almost speechless. And we will be right back with more of Kim Justice's story, an amazing story. So don't go away.
Mm-hmm. WQ4D Radio enters 2012 with four diverse and entertaining shows on the Inspiring Friends Network. Never Say Impossible with your host, Myra Goldick, features guests who will inspire, motivate, and teach you innovative ways to breathe new life into your business. Old Men's Stories is hosted by master storyteller Roland Willits, whose goal is to show you that you are already a master storyteller, that your stories and your unique experience, your life's journey, are amazing and more than worth retelling. WQ4D Radio also features Prepare for Freedom, hosted by Sharon Izzy. Enjoy fun and informative weekly podcasts designed to entertain, motivate, and inspire you to take positive action towards achieving personal, emotional, economic, and spiritual freedom for yourself, your loved ones, and the country in which you live. Inspired by Bigfoot takes a look at the controversial phenomenon known as Bigfoot. Each week, guests, questions, and comments about one of the most fascinating subjects today. With your host, Bill Lee. Inspired by Bigfoot, Prepare for Freedom, Old Men's Stories, and Never Say Impossible. Check them out at WQ4D Radio on the Inspiring Friends Network. And we're back with more of the Never Say Impossible show. Join the conversation. Our chat room is always open at www.neversayimpossible.com/chat. Or you can call into the show at 347-996-5242. And again, here's your Never Say Impossible host, Myra Goldick.
And we're back. We are back with the amazing story of a near-death experience, a brain aneurysm, and the fight for survival. Our guest is Kim Justice, and we just heard Kim's story of her near-death experience. So, picking up where we left off, we are now back. Kim is back in her own body after she experienced this riveting near-death experience, and now she's facing the rest of her life. So where are we, Kim?
Well, at this point, I would make an observation and then pick up, but in that near-death experience, my grandfather, and I suppose I shouldn't assume that people knew, he had passed away about 10 years before. I had been the only grandchild for 18 years. We had a very, very close relationship. And when I saw him in my near-death experience, he was younger than I had known him in life. There was still no doubt in my mind. The minute our eyes locked, that was, in fact, my grandfather, that was never up for grabs, but I didn't register it until much later. He was younger. He was a short Italian man who was balding, you know, gray and balding, and had a big belly the whole time I knew him. My grandfather was raised at Boys Town in an orphanage, and there were no pictures of him ever. Of his childhood or his younger days until much later, you know, when he got married and started having a family. And a miracle happens, I won't say unless we have time later on, but I could have never seen him at the age that I saw him in a photograph, because there were none. There had never been any the whole time he was alive. And a few years later, a miracle happens, and in fact, I do wind up finding something and seeing something that had never been there before. But in any case, he was younger when I ran into him on the other side than I had known him in life, and I won't interpret one way or another what that means. I don't know. You know, there's speculation. But in any case, going back to reality, of being back in my body at some point they had taken me off the life support equipment the day after I had the surgery. It took another 2 days for me to gain consciousness, but my mother was sitting with me next to me at my hospital bed on one of those days. And again, they didn't know if I was going to be able to talk, walk, function. They had no idea. But my mom thought she heard me say, "The colors are so bright," murmur that from my unconscious state. And because I hadn't talked and I wouldn't for another couple days, she thought her mind was playing tricks on her, and she must not have really heard that, or it must have been wishful thinking, and we just kind of went on with the reality of the moment. But a couple of months later, when I told her the story of what had happened, she got goosebumps, as a matter of fact, because she had, it came back to her, she had heard me say that from the state of unconsciousness. And so my mother never doubted that I saw what I saw, that I had a near-death experience and it was absolutely real and not a function of science. I did wake up, obviously, after those 3 days I came to and had no idea what had happened. They were explaining it to me, but again, I had had open brain surgery, and if I'm able to say that my website is inaflash.org.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that because there, we do want our listeners to be able to read more about you, to buy your book, to contact you if for whatever reason. So
right.
Do take the time out now to give your website.
Well, one of the reasons I brought it up now is just talking about the surgery. There's a photograph on there that gives you an idea of what that surgery might have been like that was taken immediately after. But my website is inaflash.org. And at inaflash.org, you'll find a contact the author tab. If you want to get a hold of me, there's reviews. There's some information on the book. And all of the outlets in which to buy the book. So I won't spend a lot of time on that, but my book is available on every e-book format known to man, and the paperback either directly. You can order it from me directly through my site, where it will come autographed and with a custom bookmark and promo card, or you can get it through Amazon. I'm also listed on the wholesale list used by all of the local booksellers. So theoretically, wherever you are, you can walk into your local bookstore, ask them for In a Flash, Miracles Here and Beyond by Kim Justice. They'll be able to look it up in their database and order it for you. So the availability is all outlined on the right side of my website, inaflash.org.
Well, thank you for that. And let's pick up during this long recovery process. And what were you left with? Now you're back from the surgery and you're facing what some people might consider the unthinkable, what you're going to have to go through to regain as much of what you had prior to the aneurysm.
You know, comparatively speaking, I was very blessed because I could talk when I woke up. They were all, I didn't understand, but when my first words, which were probably something like, "What happened?" when those first words came out, there was this look of jubilation on everybody's face. And you know, again, I was in a lot of pain from the surgery and on medication, so I'm kind of in foggy land. But I also remember having the awareness. I wondered why everyone looked so joyful at the fact that I spoke, you know, because I didn't get the gravity of what had happened. Again, I'm 35 years old. You're bulletproof at that age. And I had no idea what had gone on. And I was extremely weak and had trouble you know, walking, had trouble with any kind of energy. So, in fact, I slept quite a bit. But I was, again, blessed that my parents were able and willing. I would have had to have gone to a care facility for a month or 6 weeks had they not been willing to take me in. My speech was fine. To look at me, well, to look at me right after surgery wasn't a pretty sight, but I mean, I, by all appearance, after you've had brain surgery, it appeared that I wasn't going to have deficits in the very beginning, only because I could walk with assistance and talk. And so the things that I was experiencing, the pain, the not being able to remember anything, my thoughts being jumbled, being more emotional, those things were attributed to the trauma. And it was thought that they would probably resolve in time. And I somewhat fell through some medical cracks in the healthcare system at this point, because when the neurosurgeon, you know, I did have a couple of follow-up visits with him. I wasn't able to drive for about 5 months. I wound up spending 4 weeks, not 6 weeks, with my folks. I really wanted to go home. I had some pets at home, and I think, you know, when I look at it in retrospect, everything was so unfamiliar, different, traumatic, out of the blue. It wasn't that my parents' house wasn't unfamiliar, but it wasn't my house.
And, you were an adult, and you wanted to take control of your life again. I can totally understand that, even though you weren't really well.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I wasn't well. I was going to have to stay in bed and kind of use the walls as I was staggering to get to the bathroom and so forth. But I wanted to go home to my own house, and I pleaded with the doctor to let me go home. And of course, my folks wanted me to stay, as folks would, to make sure that I was okay. But the doctor said, you know, let her try. You know, let her try to do what she can do, and let's not hold her back. And she'll know soon enough, you know, she's not able, and she'll be back. So I appreciated him giving me the opportunity to do that. And I had some really scary times when I was on my own, because one of my early problems was dizziness and vertigo, and again, you know, my emotions swung pretty wildly, and I couldn't remember. I would try to grasp thoughts and couldn't quite lay my hands on them, and you know, things improved a little over time, but even still, I have problems with those things that did not, in fact, resolve. And some days I have what I call an full basket syndrome, and it's when too many things are going on. I get really agitated and emotional, and then it's almost like you take a full file drawer from the office and dump it upside down on a windy day. You know, I can't grasp the thoughts, you know, the whole process with that is when you knew who you were and how you functioned, and suddenly you're not able to do that, there's some panic, anxiety, frustration.
Anger, I imagine.
And anger, yeah.
Yeah.
And anger, yes. Yes, because I just wanted, one of the things that I did, and this is one of the problems with my after effects. I'll go back to my point in falling through the healthcare cracks. I saw the neurosurgeon a few times for follow-up, and basically, you know, he saw that he put Humpty back together again, and there wasn't an obvious thing that he could address, and so he cut me loose. Well, that internal medicine doctor I had that had misdiagnosed me, my confidence in him was completely undermined, and I never went back to him again. I was very angry and afraid of him. You know,
with good reason.
Yes, I didn't want to go back to him, and I don't know if the neurosurgeon just assumed I would go back to my internist, or if protocol was different. I really can't give you the answer except to say nobody ever suggested that I see a neurologist, that I have follow-up, turned me on to any kind of support group. I was really just left out there to figure it out on my own, as were my parents. You know, none of us knew what was going on, and just the basics were explained. This is what happened. This is how I fixed it. These are some of the things that could happen, and there you go. Throw you in the deep end of the pool, and you try to live your life, then go on and live your life and go through recovery without any guidance. And so it was much later in the year that I found a new internist, and he's coming in after the fact. Again, I was never told. And one of the things, you know, then going back is I was still having these problems. And one of the things is that when they cut through your head and the muscles in your face, you know, there's bound to be some damage, whether you want to call it a neuropathy kind of damage or nerve damage, but a pain condition. And I have a dent up on the left side of my forehead under my bangs, where they had taken out a piece of my skull to access my brain for the surgery. And from that soft spot, I call it, or the dent, from there down to the left side of my jaw, a little half moon, that nerve really never completely resolved. So I've lived with chronic pain and tried nearly every kind of remedy for that they have in the healthcare field, which is basically drugs, and in the alternative healthcare field, you know, tried some various things, and that never really went away. My vision, I wound up having a lot of floaters in my vision. I can drive, I can see, but my vision was compromised to some degree from what it was before. It's kind of like looking out a dirty window. Again, the emotional swings are prevalent, relevant, however you want to put it. I hadn't had that problem before my surgery, and after my surgery, when things get too overwhelming or at inappropriate times, I'll have emotional responses. And again, the memory is frustrating, only because, you know, you compare yourself. One of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, you're used to the you that you know and that you're familiar with, and your ways of functioning and your quote-unquote normal. And you go through a life-changing experience, you know, in this case a medical condition, and it resolves the way it's going to resolve, but then you're left with a new
learning
me.
To live with it.
Right. Who's the new me, and how's this going to work? And because there wasn't, I was recovering in isolation, and I'll explain that briefly in a couple of minutes, something I found out when I wrote my book, I didn't know. Doctors weren't validating. My new internist wasn't really validating. He was just trying to give me, you know, drugs to help different things. But ultimately, as they do, unfortunately, I don't want to paint a broad brush, but with a lot of women, and maybe men too, but I hear it a lot more from women. You know, mm-hmm. If they don't have the solution readily, and you don't shut up with the prescription they write out, then ultimately you get sent to the psychiatrist. And
Oh, I know that. It's so funny because that's really my story. You know, of course, that I survived a devastating bout of polio when I was very young. And what no one knew at the time, after the Salk vaccine was distributed, which was just about the same year that I had the disease, they didn't know that polio is a neurological disease. And if you develop post-polio syndrome, which comes anywhere from 15 to 20 years, maybe even 30 years after the initial onset, the brain lesions that are caused change you completely. And you are, it's a very strange neurological disease, and they knew nothing. So if you went to the doctor and complained about symptoms that you were developing, very similar to any kind of brain injury, they would say, well, honey, look how good you look. Don't
right.
worry about
right.
polio.
Right.
And I wasn't taken seriously, and there were times that I thought I was the crazy neurotic one.
Me too.
And I'm sure you experienced that.
I did. I think, you know, you hit on something. When you look normal, that's a real handicap for those of us that have something wrong, because that's exactly where the medical profession goes. You know, if you can walk and talk and you look normal,
mm-hmm.
they haven't been there and they don't have a ready answer. And I think they could handle it differently. But yes, exactly what you said, that worked against me and you, I guess, you know, and a lot of people, that when you look normal, if the
prescription... And particularly women.
Oh, I see that all the time. You know, and I won't say that a trip, after you've had a life-threatening experience, I'm not saying that a trip to a shrink is a bad idea. You know,
yeah.
It's a good idea to help you.
I went through years of therapy.
Right,
know,
as have I.
Good.
So, yes,
mm-hmm.
And I recommend having help getting through trauma, but it's just, you know, with me, I didn't even realize, the first place I wanted to go was denial. And, I mean, in an obvious way, I couldn't deny what had happened, but it was so, nobody ever recommended that I go to a shrink either in that first year, and that first year is when I was recovering and finding out the things that weren't going to go away, and feeling like they should be, because the doctor said they would be, and so I wanted to pretend, you know, I wanted to just get past this. And I think, you know, for my whole family, that the thing was so horrific, so out of the blue, so unexpected, that I think we all wanted to just move forward, you know, move forward. And that lends itself to, you asked me about writing my book and that time lapse between. And I think things happen the way that they're supposed to. As it turns out in my book, when people read it, there were some things that were going to come later that were going to fully round my story. And so, but at the time, I did journal my experience in those months that I was off work. I journaled what had happened, and I did the old-fashioned method of copywriting. I mailed it to myself and never opened it. So I had a postmarked envelope with the journaling I did of my experience and my recovery, and I threw it in a plastic bin down a basement, and it moved to three houses over over the next 17 years and never saw the light of day. You know, it was just in one of those tubs you don't open that someday you need to just, like, throw the whole thing away or finally go through it, you know. But in any case, in those early years, I didn't want to revisit the horror and the trauma of that situation. I looked normal, so I wanted to be normal. And the doctors were telling me, you know, what they were telling me. And so it took me a year and a half to make it to a psychiatrist. So in that first
year... Well, that, but that, I think, is admirable, because it took me a lot longer to go to a psychiatrist. But I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it's the denial. You just want to be normal again. And you, what you went through was bad enough the first time. To admit to it seems like you're defeated. So that denial comes back to haunt you. I do understand that completely.
Well, and even more so, I had been dating a fella at the time. And going back to the near-death experience, when I said my mom believed me, the person I was dating, he proposed to me a month. Let's see, it happened in January. He proposed to me in April, around the time of my birthday, and we got married in October of 1995. And so, what I did to get away and distance myself from my illness is I got married. And first of all, I wouldn't recommend getting married in back of brain surgery. But the sense I made of it at the time, think about it, I had grown up in a generation where I desired, it was my dream that I was going to grow up, get married, and have a family. That's what people do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
I always thought there was time later, you know, later to do that, because I led a very full life and I was 35 years old. I almost died and missed it, for Pete's sake. And so
that's true.
Mm-hmm. You know, I nearly died and missed that childhood dream I had always thought was a foregone conclusion. And so when he asked me to marry him, and by the way, my story is absolutely true. There's only two names I changed in my book, and one of them was the name of my first husband, and the other one was the name of that big client that was a miracle, because finances weren't one of the things, out of the many things I was going to have to worry about. God set it up, as far as I'm concerned, that I landed that account when I did, so that I was financially secure in this new house I had just bought, and the responsibilities that I had accrued at that time. I wasn't going to have to be worrying about money. But when I told my ex-husband, I mean, well, now he's my my husband-to-be at that time, about my experience, he was in medical school. He went on to be a doctor. I put him through medical school, and I told him about my near-death experience, and he immediately poo-pooed it, told me that that was a function of the medicine, you know, the medicine that they had me on in the hospital. It was very strong drugs, and that what I thought had happened hadn't happened, and that I was silly to think that that was the case. Those kind of things don't happen. It was a lack of oxygen to my brain and a morphine combination that made me have a hallucination.
Oh, boy, we are at the top of the hour, and there is so much more to talk about. I guess our listeners are just going to have to read your book to get all the information, and visit Kim's website so that you can find out what you can do if someone you love has had a similar experience and what resources are available, or contact Kim directly at, one more time, Kim?
My website is inaflash.org. Again, inaflash.org. And on there, you'll find all of the outlets that the book is available, which are many. You'll find a contact the author tab if you want to get a hold of me, more information about the book and some of the other things I'm doing now to advocate. My book is really about miracles. It is my story of survival, but there were a lot of miracles.
It definitely is a story of survival, and I have to let you go and thank you so much for sharing this important information with our listeners, and we do welcome you back. So thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you so much, Myra. I really appreciate you giving me the time. Thanks to the listeners.
And I thank the listeners. And remember, the Never Say Impossible family embraces the infinite opportunities that exist for all of us every day of our life. If you have a message you would like to share with the world, please contact Myra or Sharon at WQ4DRadio.com or visit us on Facebook and join our Inspiring Friends group. Inspiring Friends Network celebrates the intimacy of the human voice, and it is first and foremost. The universe has no limits, nor does your voice, through the miracle of internet radio. Thank you for listening, and remember, never say impossible.
You've been listening to the Never Say Impossible show on the Inspiring Friends Network. For more information about this show and how you can take advantage of a powerful, unique opportunity to tell the world your story, your accomplishments, your passions, and about your products, email Myra at inspiringfriends.net or call 561-429-8268. And remember, never say impossible.